It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Pope Leo today amid weeks of tension between the Vatican and the White House.
The meeting comes after a new Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll found negative public opinion over President Trump's criticism of the Pope and a recent social media post appearing to depict the president as Jesus.
President Trump has said he thought the post depicted him as a doctor or Red Cross worker.
The Pope spoke with journalists Tuesday night after leaving the papal retreat near Rome, saying, quote, "The mission of the church is to preach the gospel, to preach peace." He went on to say that the Catholic Church has consistently spoken out against nuclear weapons.
"And I always believe that it's much better to enter into dialogue than to look for arms and to support the arms industry, which gains billions and billions of dollars each year, instead of sitting down at the table, solving our problems, and using money to solve humanitarian issues."
That audio is from the Associated Press. Wisconsin is home to more than 1 million Catholics. We're checking in on the political tensions with Father Stephen Avella, a Milwaukee Catholic priest and professor emeritus of history at Marquette University. Father Avella, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you. Good to talk to you.
President Trump continues to openly clash with Pope Leo. Is this an unusual moment for the Catholic Church to have political issues like this flare up with a world leader?
When you're talking about President Trump's public declarations or the things that he puts on his social media, I'm going to leave that to you folks in the Fourth Estate to figure out what that is and what that means. There are things that he says and does that confronts some of the main thrust of Catholic teaching, particularly the preservation of life. And in terms of desiring strategies that resolve international conflicts by dialogue, by treaties, by concordats, by ways other than killing, shooting, sending tomahawk missiles, what have you. This has been a consistent preference of the church since the onset of modern warfare, all right? Since really World War I. The church has always been on the side of, can we talk about this? Can we sit down? Can we find a way to preserve order, unity by dialogue rather than weaponry?
You're breaking up just a moment there. But what do you make of the fact that President Trump and Pope Leo aren't meeting face-to-face?
Well, I assume that there's a possibility for phone dialogue. That was raised in a news story that I just read, that Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State, the person who would be the go-to person to arrange such a thing, suggested that the Pope would be open to that, and I don't see why he wouldn't. I'm not quite sure what that would produce. Again, when you're dealing with things that President Trump says or how he presents things, again, I'm going to leave that to you people in the Fourth Estate to figure that out. What does this mean? What are we hearing here? What's real and what's not real? And so, again, I would think the Holy Father would be more than open to be a participant, a discussant, in these things. But he's the subject of these attacks. Right? He wants them to have a nuclear bomb. He likes crime. Is this really a fair basis on which to base, you know, an honest dialogue?
Father Avella, closer to home here in Wisconsin, does tension between the Pope and the president rise to the level of an issue you feel the need to address to a full congregation, say, on a Sunday morning?
I haven't done it myself because I don't often celebrate Mass on a Sunday, but I know my priest brothers have, and they've spoken to this issue and tried to clarify what was going on, respectful of the diversity, the legitimate diversity of opinions there are about the president and about the state of political affairs today. But yes, this is something. What's going on here? How do we understand this? How do we understand this as Catholics? We have a loyalty to the Pope. We priests, we take, before we are ordained, we pledge ourselves to be obedient in heart and in mind to the teaching of the Church as manifested by the voice of the Pope. So we have an obligation to defend him and to try and understand what he says and interpret that and speak that as clearly as possible, and then to trust the wisdom of the people of God to sort this out and to say what's real here and what's not real. We stand for peace. We stand for the dignity of human life from conception to natural death. We are not in favor of war. In particular, nuclear war has become is problematic. It's morally and ethically problematic. This is almost from the time of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of the first voices to speak about the dubiousness of using nuclear weapons was Pope Pius XII. John XXIII made a same declaration in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And John Paul II, every pope down to the present, has expressed grave reservations about the morality of nuclear warfare.
Thank you for that historical context. We are talking about tensions between Pope Leo and the Trump administration, how Catholics in Wisconsin are navigating them. Father Stephen Avella is with us, a Milwaukee Catholic priest and professor emeritus of history at Marquette University. Father Avella, President Trump has made the case that Pope Leo is wrong to oppose the war in Iran because he thinks it's necessary to ensure Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons. How does the Catholic Church weigh that dilemma of using violence if it could prevent the potential for greater harm?
In certain circumstances, yes. But the main nuclear armed power in the Middle East now is not Iran, it's Israel. So if we're interested in eliminating the nuclear threat or acquiring nuclear arms, I think the Holy See, which oversees the entire world, would be interested in an even-handed approach to this. Yes, first of all, the Pope has never endorsed Iran having nuclear weapons, nor ever been a fan of the current Iranian regime. I think most people are convinced that it's not a good place. That being said, let's take on the whole issue of nuclear proliferation. The Vatican has always been out in front in nuclear non-proliferation. They have always urged nuclear countries to kind of demobilize, to step back, to create an environment where this kind of circumstance is not coming in. But to accuse the Pope of wanting Iran to have nuclear weapons, it's just not valid. It's not legitimate.
Have you been surprised at all by the Pope's willingness to push back against the president and engage on this with him?
Yes, in the tradition of his predecessors. This is a very important motif in understanding the papacy. What popes have said and what popes have done constitute a strand of tradition with a capital T in our faith life that popes observe and then forward according to their own particular circumstances. Mm-hmm. Pius XII expressed grave reservations about the atomic bombing of Japan. John XXIII became even more forceful about them. John Paul II went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and said, this should never happen again. Every pope has expressed misgivings about the acquisition and development of nuclear arms and the potential for their use in the destruction of civilizations. A civilization will die tonight. how would any religious leader react to a statement like that?
Father Avella, I want to switch gears for just a moment. It's been 1 year since Pope Leo was elected to lead the Catholic Church. How is he doing as pontiff?
Well, the polls are any indication. People like him, appreciate him. They're certainly anxious for him to come back to Chicago. I was just in Chicago for a couple of weeks, and they're all anxious to welcome back the hometown boy.
I would imagine, yes.
There would be, there'll be a lot of White Sox hats sold around Chicago and all that. But he comes with many gifts. First of all, he's multilingual and multicultural. I mean, he lived there in Peru for a long time. His mastery of Italian and Spanish
and even other Romance languages is marvelous. Secondly, this man has had administrative ability. He ran the Augustinian order, which is a worldwide order. So he knows how things work. And in his last job, he was the head of the office that creates bishops around the world, nominates men for these critical posts of bishops in various countries. So he brings a really strong dossier, and on top of that, a kind of a humble and unassuming personality. And for me, he's a historic pope. For the first time in my life, I'm older than the pope.
Very quickly, when you saw President Trump's social media post last month appearing to depict himself as a Jesus-like figure, what was your reaction?
I was offended. This is ridiculous. But then again, this is what we've come to expect. This is the kind of stuff, the sort of nonsense that passes for public discourse now, that we just kind of shrug our shoulders at and say, well, he's just doing what he's doing. I found it offensive. And when he dressed himself up as the Pope, when Pope Francis was dying, that too I found needlessly offensive. Why do that? Again, my questions, I'm sure the same questions that you and the Fourth Estate have. What on earth is going on here? What on earth is going on here with these middle-of-the-night social media unloadings and these ridiculous images? Is this the way that the leader of the free world acts? Is this in keeping with the dignity of an office held by men like Dwight Eisenhower, Franklin Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln? Is this what we've come to expect and live with? No, I was offended. I did not find that amusing. I'm not going to jump in, oh, it was blasphemous, because I just think it's silly. It's just absolutely silly.
Father Avella, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Father Stephen Avella is a Milwaukee Catholic priest, professor emeritus of history at Marquette University. He was with us to share how he's navigating political tensions between the Trump administration and Pope Leo.
Coming up, Wisconsin isn't the only state dealing with PFAS pollution. The author of a new book shares lessons from Maine, including dairy farmers who spoke out about high PFAS levels in their milk.
Having farmers advocate before the legislature was pivotal in getting policy change and much more state support for the farming community.
The book Inescapable is next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. After years of back and forth in the state legislature over how to spend funding to address PFAS contamination, in April, Governor Evers signed two bills into law that release $133 million to help communities deal with this widespread pollutant.
A growing body of research has linked PFAS exposure to serious health risks, including certain types of cancer and child developmental and fertility issues.
This influx of funding will help with PFAS testing and remediation efforts around the state, including money for new wells and a provision to protect, quote, innocent landowners who have pollution on their property through no fault of their own.
The state of Maine has been down this path. In 2021, its lawmakers passed major legislation aimed at fixing the state's own PFAS crisis and invested more than $200 million in the effort.
Where does Maine stand now, 5 years later? That's the topic of a new book that looks at the state's PFAS story with lessons for other states that are enacting policies and allocating funds.
Marina Schaffler is an environmental writer. Her new book is called Inescapable: Facing Up to Forever Chemicals. Marina, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Your book starts with the story of Fred Stone, a dairy farmer who discovered high PFAS levels in his milk. And he didn't stay quiet about this. He didn't go about his business as usual with his herd of 150 cows. Can you talk about the chain of events that happened and what set it off?
Certainly. He had been on that land for three generations. And when he heard that there were these chemicals in his well water and then his milk tested for them as well. He was blindsided initially, really not understanding the source. And the state did a lot of testing on the site, and it gradually became clear that he had, with complete state sanction, the state had encouraged farmers in previous decades to spread sludge, both municipal and industrial sludge, on their land. And the high PFAS levels he found tied directly back to the sludge applications. And at first, the state wasn't eager to acknowledge that this might be a more widespread problem. And so he had to really speak repeatedly and push for the legislature to do further testing. And when the state did further testing of both dairy farms and other farms where sludge had been permitted in the past, they found recurrent problems.
Mm. So he was licensed to spread this wastewater sludge on his fields, not knowing he was also spreading PFAS. And then he has to kill off most of his cows to contain the spread. Their business is ruined. Did Maine public agencies help or get the picture of what was going on?
Initially, in the first few years, there wasn't much support for Fred and Laura Stone. And it was devastating, as you say, for them. They were already starting to struggle with health problems. Their business was decimated. The value of the farm that was their primary asset was diminished. It was very challenging. And he finally came forward publicly to put more pressure on the state and get some more support for the farming community. And as other farmers discovered the problem, farmers testified before the legislature. Having farmers advocate before the legislature was pivotal in getting policy change and much more state support for the farming community and others affected by past sludge spreading.
And Maine was an early leader among states to start to address PFAS contamination, to start to put money toward it and figure out policies. How did Maine get people to care about invisible forever chemicals that are persistently lurking in the waters and in soil and elsewhere?
I think a lot of people in Maine are deeply attached to the place and value the health and well-being of our natural environment. So it was really the way that PFAS had undermined that was crushing for a lot of people. And the way it was affecting rural communities made it a unifying issue in the legislature. The initial support was very bipartisan, and it felt like an affront to the people of the state to have this kind of ubiquitous and persistent contamination in a place that we want to be healthy.
One physician you interview called PFAS contamination a slow-moving environmental disaster that's uprooting people's lives, and that there's this psychological toll alongside, of course, the health risks and PFAS exposure. What did you hear from people dealing with PFAS contamination on their property?
That is a good description, because it just festers for people. They have this uncertainty around future health concerns, and there are a wide array of potential health impacts. And so one farmer described it as sort of like a ticking time bomb with a faulty wiring, you know, just knowing that there would likely be impacts and kind of having to wait and watch because there's not too much that can be done. There's work underway, research underway here on some promising leads that might help lower PFAS blood levels. But in the early years, that wasn't even known. So
it has been, and then there's the diminishment of their property values and not being able to pursue a lot of passions. You know, people couldn't hunt or fish where they had traditionally done that. People who had gardens, you know, couldn't eat their own produce anymore. They weren't sure about, you know, locally what was safe to buy. They weren't sure about what in the supermarkets because there's so little testing on PFAS. So it introduced a huge amount of uncertainty and stress in people's lives.
I want to zoom in on paper mills because you mentioned sludge, and Maine has more than a dozen paper mills still functioning. Wisconsin, we here have upwards of 30. What is the role of paper mills in PFAS pollution?
The paper mills that produce coated papers, so water-resistant, stain-resistant, like foodware that is coated or other coated papers, use PFAS in that process. And when the paper mill discharges that, the ones here had no treatment prior to going to the municipal treatment plant. And those, of course, are designed for biological treatment, but not for removing persistent chemicals like PFAS. So that was just going right through the system into the sludge and into the waste discharge as well in wastewater. But the sludge would concentrate the chemicals to some degree. And then for decades, that had been land applied both in farm settings and actually in some forest ones here as well.
And I should note that has happened here in Wisconsin, too. And our DNR confirmed last year that paper companies were primarily responsible for PFAS-contaminated sludge that was getting spread on farm fields. What steps has Maine taken to address this issue of the sludge on farm fields?
Maine was the first state to ban the application of sludge to farm fields and the use of compost containing sludge, because some sludge was also going into composting facilities and then getting redistributed out to gardens and athletic playing fields and a whole range of settings as well. So that was instrumental in stopping the distribution of PFAS into food growing settings, mm-hmm. but we pretty quickly, the legislature realized it needed to move upstream and turn off the tap. So Maine was among the first states to start putting bans on various categories of consumer products, and it went very ambitious initially with that product ban and discovered pretty quickly that it was really difficult for people to trace the supply chain back and figure out where PFAS was, you know, in their products. And Maine is a small state. It's 1.3 million people. So it made it challenging in terms of having enough influence on changes in industry practice. But as other states have come along with more consumer bans, and Maine revised its product bans to align more with Minnesota. So as more and more states adopt product bans and align them, it is going to stop the flow into the waste stream. And it makes it really easier for industry to modify their practices because the states are on a similar time frame.
We're talking about how Maine has been addressing PFAS pollution in their state and what Wisconsin can learn. Marina Schaffler has a new book. It's called Inescapable: Facing Up to Forever Chemicals. Marina, out of that 2021 legislative session in Maine came a rapid policy response addressing PFAS from a variety of angles. You've named some, putting in $200 million around that number in the first 2 years. What results did the state see?
One place that the state has put a lot of money, 60 or 70 million of that has gone towards a fund, and it sounds like Wisconsin may be following a similar track in supporting those affected. So that has enabled farmers to pivot their businesses to, in most cases, they've been able to sustain their operations, but potentially grow different crops or different approaches. In a few cases where that's not been feasible, it allows for buyouts of the farms. It has supported farmers financially in the process of working through the testing, in supporting their own health testing, and even mental wellness support, because this is a pretty traumatic experience for people who encounter high contamination. The process of setting up that fund involved a lot of farmers, so it really reflected their needs quite well, I think.
How are those farmers doing today? Do you have any insights?
I think it's one of the challenges of PFAS is it is so persistent, and it's a long recovery. You know, and it's not a full recovery, because these chemicals so permeate our environment, and the health threat is going to linger through generations. So I think some of the most affected individuals, I think, are still struggling a lot, even though the support system has grown stronger for them.
PFAS was once this bridge-building topic for lawmakers in Maine, for communities in Maine, something, you know, you show how people could agree on and work together across political divides. And you think that that's not so much the case anymore. What has changed?
It has. There are still some areas, and some important PFAS legislation went through in this last legislative session here, with bipartisan support. But I think where the tensions became evident was when the PFAS regulations and laws bumped up against industry practice. And it was very challenging for a lot of the industries here to They can't necessarily adapt quickly to remove PFAS from the production of products, particularly those that aren't manufactured here. You know, they're using parts and components that are coming from elsewhere. So that was a source of tension. And of course, the waste industry valued having a low-cost means of sludge disposal.
Yeah. Because where do they take the sludge now? I mean, that must have been a big issue. If we can't spread it easily in our farm fields, it has to go somewhere.
And that this is a problem going back really to the Clean Water Act, where they tried ocean dumping initially, realized that wasn't a good idea. Then they went to land spreading. And now that the toxic effects of that are evident. And now there's an effort to look into drying sludge more. Currently, it's going to landfills here, which is not an optimal solution. And because the PFAS persists, it's leaching out from the landfills. And then that water, landfill leachate, has to be treated as well. So the really insidious thing about PFAS is it's just so prone to keep cycling through the system, and it underscores the importance of getting it out at the front end.
Marina, there is this theme that runs through your book about the regulatory void at the federal level and resulting in states creating this patchwork of their own policies and regulations on PFAS. We see it in Maine. We see it in Wisconsin, elsewhere. Based on Maine's experience, do you think PFAS is something that can be resolved at the state level?
Absolutely not. It is. We need federal leadership. We really need international leadership, because this is a global problem now, and it is so ubiquitous. It's cycling through the atmosphere. It's coming down in the rain. So it really needs leadership at a much larger scale. The states have worked, I think, well collaboratively in trying to align, you know, some of their legislative efforts, like Maine and Minnesota did, but it's not adequate.
Marina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Marina Schaffler is an environmental writer based in Maine. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Inescapable: Facing Up to Forever Chemicals. It looks at Maine's efforts to address PFAS contamination at the state level. Is your community working to reduce PFAS in the environment or replacing a well? How is that process going? Will the funding be able to fully cover the project? Share your perspective and where your community is at or your local utility is at with working on the PFAS crisis. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute was part of Northland College in Ashland. The college closed. We'll find out why the Environmental Institute could continue its work.
One way or the other, we're going to carry on. There's a lot of enthusiasm.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For thousands of years, a cluster of wooden canoes has lain dormant under Madison's Lake Mendota.
Now, thanks to the work of Wisconsin scientists, those ancient vessels are starting to reveal their secrets, WPR's Sarah Lear reports.
The USDA's Forest Products Lab is a big, brutalist building in an industrial area of Madison. That's where I meet Michael Wyman, where he works inside a small room stuffed with reference books and lab equipment.
Okay. So, where shall we start?
Wyman is a botanist by trade. He specializes in the anatomy, identification, and properties of tropical woods. He's into this work, and he has been for a long time.
When I was in kindergarten, my favorite toys were wood blocks. 7 decades later, what am I doing? I'm playing with wood blocks.
For the past several years, Wyman has had a special assignment. He's been helping archaeologists identify samples from ancient canoes. That includes 16 boats, all of which were discovered from the same section of Madison's Lake Mendota. And this was no easy task.
It's a hard problem to get a decent sample because Lake Mendota is not clear.
Researchers believe the canoes were made during a period of drought, when Lake Mendota was shallower than it is today. One theory is that indigenous people stashed their boats over the winter by sticking them in the side of the lake bed. After being buried underwater in sediment, they were lost to history. That's until maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson glimpsed what turned out to be part of a 1,200-year-old canoe while out diving in 2021. Since then, Thompson has returned to the same section of the lake and found 15 more ancient canoes, some of which are in pieces. It's a mission that she holds sacred.
We also hear from our tribal partners that the canoes are showing themselves because they want their stories to be told.
One of the boats in the cache is more than 5,000 years old. making it one of the oldest canoes ever discovered in North America. Bill Quackenbush, the historical preservation officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation, says the canoes tell a story about the continued presence of Native peoples.
Time and time again, we would build dugout canoes and bring ourselves back over here, or else I wouldn't even be here.
The canoes still have more stories to tell, and Wyman and other experts are working to fill in the missing pieces. Typically, archaeologists send Wyman a wooden sliver from one of the vessels. A different laboratory checks the boat's age with radiocarbon dating. Wyman's job is to figure out what type of tree the canoe is made from. He does that by sectioning the wood with a razor blade and looking for patterns under a microscope.
In this case, the vessels are two sizes, and they're in like lines, wavy lines that the vessels are joined. And that's a very distinctive feature for elm.
Elm is a difficult wood to work with, even with modern tools, says Cecil Schrader, a University of Wisconsin anthropologist who's been studying the canoes. Lake Mendota's ancient canoes are made from other species too, like oak, ash, basswood, and cottonwood. For millennia, Schrader says indigenous people made dugout canoes by knocking down trees and then hollowing them out with fire, shells, and stone tools.
Indigenous peoples were using the types of trees that were readily available.
Schrader says those species tell a story about how the climate in south-central Wisconsin has changed. For Wyman, identifying that species can take anywhere from 5 minutes to 3 days. It can be tedious, but he likes this work.
That's what makes it fun. It's a big puzzle, and once you get all the information, it starts making sense.
This spring, Thompson will try to fill in more pieces of that puzzle. She'll follow a tip left by the State Historical Society director more than a century ago. In 1909, he wrote about a cluster of canoes believed to be buried in Madison's Lake Wingra, just south of the lake where Thompson discovered the other canoes. Thompson plans to go diving in Wingra later this month. She hopes the water will be clear enough to reveal even more ancient secrets. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
More than 50 years ago, Northland College in Ashland founded the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute to spearhead environmental conservation and education efforts in the Lake Superior region.
The Institute has launched citizen scientist projects to encourage loon and wolf conservation and created an annual nature writing award. But with the closing of Northland College last year, the Institute faces an uncertain future.
A group of volunteers are working to transform the Institute into an independent nonprofit and keep it going as part of the college's legacy. Terry Dalton is vice chair of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute, and Rocky Barker is a retired journalist and author who's the Institute's treasurer. I talked to them earlier this week. Rocky, let's start with you. I understand you were a student at Northland when the Institute was founded. You knew Sigurd Olson. Can you tell us a little bit about the early days of the Institute?
So, you know, I get to Northland as a freshman in August of 1971, and I arrive on campus and I look over at the student union. And there's all these people in suits, and it turns out it's Gaylord Nelson, it's Dave Obey, it's Malcolm McLean, and people who started the Institute. And at lunch, they sat down, actually came up with the idea of setting up the Sigurd Olson Institute. So the next year, 72, I was made a member of the Student Faculty Advisory Committee. So I really was involved right from the beginning.
And what in those early days, Rocky, was the goal? What was the hope for what this institute would do?
Well, the idea of the institute was to basically design to provide the area environmental activity. The thing that they started with was to do these problem-solving workshops. And they reached out in all the small communities of bringing people who knew a lot about planning and about wildlife and fish. And that helped the communities deal with some of the problems that they were facing at the time. And it also was, you know, pushing ideas. Remember, this is a year after Earth Day, and we're passing all kinds of laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act. And so we were helping Northern Wisconsin to address these problems that now were being addressed on the federal level.
And now, Terry, the Institute grew out of Northland College. As Rocky said, Northland has closed its doors now. Why is it important for the state as a whole, do you think, for this institute to carry on that mission?
Well, the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute has always had sort of a special niche where we looked at the Northwoods and the greater Lake Superior region and tried to focus on things that mattered to the people in that region. Also, in some ways, it was a bit like University Extension for Northland College, but we were also reaching out with a message about what were the spiritual connections, what were the emotional connections, what is it that sustains those cultures around this region, around the natural resources and cultural issues. So we tried to take what Northland had, which was a liberal arts environmental message, and infuse that into the communities. What does it mean when you're not just looking at the science, but looking at everything across the community from philosophy, religion, the social sciences, how do we react to the environment around us and bring that all together? So we're looking at a whole in that regional context.
And Terry, what did that look like in practice where it was, of course, Northland students themselves were part of this? What did it look like when you were bringing this to the community beyond the school?
Well, it changed over the years, but we had many different projects that cycled through. One of the ones that I worked with a lot was the Loon Watch program, which worked started as a citizen science program to document loon populations and habitat needs in the Lake Superior and northern Wisconsin and Lake Superior area. But we had other projects like the Timberwolf Alliance, like the Lake Superior Binational Forum. We started a number of sustainability initiatives in the Shawangan Bay area and beyond. So we really looked, as things changed over time, we looked at what were those issues as the communities grew and changed that we could help address.
We're talking about the future of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute after the closure of Northland College. We have Terry Dalton with us, vice chair of the Institute, Rocky Barker, treasurer, a longtime connection, as we heard, to the Institute. Let's look toward the future now, Rocky. Northland College, I understand, seeking to turn over about $1 million of its endowment to help keep that institute going. Where are you in this process of figuring out the funding for the Institute?
Well, that is in court right now. So at the moment, we really don't have any control over that. And so what we're doing is we're trying to reach out to the community and do basic fundraising. You know, that money is a part of an endowment. We hope to keep it as an endowment. And that means we'll still need considerable money for the year-to-year, day-to-day operations. And so that's kind of what we're working on at the moment. And managing the programs that we are still doing.
Terry, as this outreach is going on, what has been the response from the community? Do you see a desire, a drive to keep the Sigurd Olson Institute around?
We've heard nothing but thanks from people who have been active in the past and people in the area. I think people will be interested in what the mission of the organization is moving forward. I think we actually are in a unique situation to take a look at the Sigurd Olson Institute over the last 50 or so years, and then where do we want to go in the future? What does the philosophy and work of the Institute and of Sigurd Olson mean for next generations down the road? Things have changed over time since the 1970s, and I think we're uniquely positioned to help us guide the region and help us think about the most important issues as we move forward, whether it's climate change, sustainable populations, and our relationship to nature here in northern Wisconsin and beyond.
And Terry, you mentioned the Loon Watch, and I think people have birds on their mind this time of year. Tell us a little bit about this citizen science project. How do people participate?
Well, Loon Watch started in 1978, shortly after the Institute was founded, and at that time, we didn't have a lot of information on loons in the state. Loons are kind of an interesting species because they fall between categories that most natural resource agencies deal with. They're not a game species, nor are they threatened or endangered in Wisconsin. So no one was really tracking them or monitoring them. Yet when you think about it, loons are an icon of the Northwoods, very important to our experiences on Northern Lakes, to how we feel about those places that we connect to, whether it's on vacation or for second homes or year-round homeowners. So we started this program to first try to document where loons were living and nesting, what were their habitat needs, and we've been doing that for almost 50 years. It's one of the oldest citizen science programs in Wisconsin, and we're still an important database that the DNR and other organizations come to when they're looking at management options on lakes, when they're looking at water quality. Loons are, in some ways, an indicator species for lake health. They require clear, clean water, healthy fish populations, and a relative level of space and tranquility to pull off nesting and having chicks.
Rocky, I want to hear a little bit more about Sigurd Olsen, a very lifelong connection with Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin in particular. You overlapped with him, as you mentioned, in your time at Northland. Can you tell us a little bit about Sigurd Olsen?
What was really interesting for me as a young student was he spoke directly to us when he'd speak at Northland. He was talking about a new generation that was going to, in new jobs that weren't even created then. Well, you know, he was, so he was thinking, you know, 50 years ahead at that time. And, you know, one of the things he was, of all of the environmental leaders at that time, he was really one of the most connected to his spiritual side. And that was a really important factor in his life and the importance of wildness in all of our lives. And I think that's kind of what, I was, when I got to speak with him, he talked about, even down in Sealy, where his wife Elizabeth was from, that feeling that he had being out in the woods.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Terry, kind of a pulse check. How positive do you feel that, yes, indeed, the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute will carry on Sigurd's mission into the future?
Oh, I think one way or the other, we're going to carry on. We already have our Loon Rangers out working on lakes. Timberwolf Alliance is active and moving programs forward. And there's a lot of enthusiasm. And we have a great board and volunteers that have stepped up. So folks who are interested should drop us an email or visit our website, SigurdOlsenEnvironmentalInstitute.org. And we're starting to get good lists of folks who want to help and hoping to bring more people in as we develop more capacity.
We'll leave it there. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having us.
And Rocky, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. And stay tuned for the Sigurd Olsen Nature Writing Awards are going to come out pretty soon.
That was Terry Dalton, Vice Chair of the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute, and Rocky Barker, graduate of Northland College and the Institute's treasurer, been talking about their efforts to keep the Institute up and running after the closure of Northland College. How are the roads in your part of the state? On Monday, we'll hear from the head of Wisconsin's Transportation Department, and we want to hear from you, too, at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or 888-642-0232.
Are you encountering lots of potholes on your local roads? Are there roads or highways that you think need some repair or expansion? Or is there a highway you think doesn't need to be a highway anymore?
What do you want to see the state focus on when it comes to transportation? Roads? New roads? Fixing old ones? How about bikes or rail?
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.